episode 060, Business Broken to Smoking Podcast. Mark Whitmore, head coach at Lodestone True North, riding solo today on our podcast. And we're going to be talking about this continuing theme of interviewing, of really getting great people on your team, and the challenges, why it's so important, and how I notice that many entrepreneurs, many managers and leaders just aren't that good at interviewing, or they kind of take it as a bit of an afterthought. It kind of comes up pretty randomly, and they seem to just, from my perspective, kind of flail at it or kind of fake it or just make it up as they go. And there's really a lot of very, very good history and data and tips and tricks from practitioners out there. And my goal here is to share a little bit of that with you as a leader, manager, entrepreneur, so that you can do a much better job of determining if the person that you're talking to in an interviewing situation, a future hire, a potential hire, if they're going to be a good fit, if they're going to be a good fit for your team, good fit for the mission of your organization, if they're going to be the kind of people that you can go the distance with. And we know that if they're not, that is a very expensive mistake. Mistakes in hiring, hiring the wrong person has been shown to be 10 times the cost of the paycheck. So you've got the paycheck, and let's say it's $100,000, and you hire the wrong person, they're a bad hire, it can be upwards of $1 million in cost to the organization. And I've seen this practically played out many times. And they say that a manager, a bad hire in a manager or a leader is 15 times the cost of the paycheck. So then that cost is in things like reputation. It's in things like culture, the cost to your culture. A lot of times you have a bad hire, it can cause good hires to lose their way. It can cost you in kind of that esprit de corps, if you will, or in the kind of the chemistry that gets developed in a good team. And when you have a bad hire, the good folks say to themselves, whether directly or indirectly, they say to themselves, the boss doesn't know what they're doing, and it starts to erode their confidence in you. And ultimately, those folks will leave. The healthy folks will ultimately leave when they get a chance to. So that's one of the costs. Another cost in a bad hire is your reputation in the marketplace. A bad hire can erode your name with your clients. With your customers, your customer base, and also in your branding, it can kind of erode that too, depending on how visible or outward or interactive this hire is with your customers. Eventually, it's going to get to them. Another place that it is a cost, a bad hire is a cost, is in the bandwidth of the manager to lead and manage that person. That bandwidth is costly. You're paying as an entrepreneur, as an owner, or as a key leader, you're paying to have that manager or leader in that position. And a lot of that expensive bandwidth, or costly bandwidth, valuable, I guess I would say, is eaten up by bad hires. And when that bandwidth is eaten up, then there are really important things that are being left undone, or there are really painful problems that aren't being solved, or there's really important victories that aren't being won, or strategies that aren't being built, or innovations that aren't being come up with, or maintenance on very important key processes or systems or pieces of equipment that are not happening because that manager is busy putting out fires or busy hand-holding or babysitting or whatever the metaphor is there. So that's another cost in a bad hire. So the place where we begin to kind of figure out if we've got a good hire in front of us is the interviewing process. That is the key. That's the beginning of this relationship with your future hire. And this is the place that I just see a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of leaders and managers, I'm going to use the word mail it in. They just check the box, you know. And if you think about your interviewing process, let me take a sip of my coffee. And I'll say my interviewing process, well, first of all, I'm terrible at interviewing future hires, but I'm good at helping my clients figure out how to do it. I'm going to say here that a good cup of coffee always helps. Now, there's some basics here, and I'm going to be taking some information from The Ideal Team Player, which is a Pat Lencioni book. It's a great, simple read. It's very, very enlightening. It's very easy to access. As an entrepreneur, you can rip through this thing in 4 or 5 hours on audio. I would encourage you to get the print copy, and I would encourage you to do a couple of things here. First of all, if you want kind of a PDF distillation of this book, there's a number of them out there. I like going to Reading Graphics, which is reading and then graphics with no G. There's just one G in it, readinggraphics.com. And for, I think, $10 or $15, you can get a PDF distillation of the book. It's kind of like a cheat sheet, if you will. And so I'm drawing from that. I've bought many copies of this book. I would buy copies of this book for yourself and your key managers, anybody that's interviewing. And it's kind of around the premise, this book, Ideal Team Player, is around the premise that, or the assumption that there are these three qualities that make up an ideal team player. And they're kind of no-brainers. Like, these are not exactly core values. They could be core values. They are around the kind of the three pillars, I suppose, of our thinking process. Maybe that's the wrong word here, but the way we process. And so it's kind of how we think, how we act, or how we think, how we feel, and how we work. So our cognitive, or, you know, thinking process, and then how we feel, or you could say how we treat one another, and then how we get things done. And so he boils those down into humble, hungry, and smart. Three really solid, key, absolutely non-negotiable qualities that have to be in an ideal team player. And so before I jump into these, and what I'm going to do today is read some of his interviewing. This is Pat Lencioni, who came up with this. And the Table Group is his organization that kind of executes around these and consults around these. And I've used these in my consulting practice to help my clients learn how to interview better. Okay, so some fundamentals here. So first of all, when you have an ideal team player, they have to embody these three qualities: humble, hungry, and smart. And I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about what it means to be humble, what it means to be hungry, what it means to be smart, and what the kind of interplay between these looks like. Second of all, I'm going to give you some interviewing questions that Pat Lencioni puts out on his website. And if you want to download these or look these up, you can go to thetablegroup.com And then you find your way to the ideal team player page. I think it's the book page. And then there's a page called tools and resources. And then on, in that page, there's a number of different guides or different kind of PDFs you can download. And one of them is called the interviewer's guide. Now, by the way, there's another one called the manager's assessment, which is great once you've hired a person to kind of keep your finger on the pulse of, hey, how are they doing around humble, hungry, and smart? And it's kind of a manager's cheat sheet on how to in a quarterly or an annual or some sort of check-in with your direct report, you know, to kind of get a sense of how they're doing for yourself as the manager. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to go through these questions, first of all. And then second of all, I want to set some context here around interviewing. So one of the mistakes that I've seen my clients make is they miss the big picture, okay? They kind of lose the macro reason we're interviewing in the first place. So that's one thing I want you to set down on paper here is to say, what are we trying to do? When we interview, and I would zoom out even further, we're trying to get people into our organization. Why? And I would start with that. Before you do any interviewing, start with this hack that I call, or tool that I call, the guardrails, you know, where you say to yourself in a contemplative, strategic setting, before you do anything, and this is thinking now, thinking work, to say to yourself, all right, so I need to get some folks into this organization. Well, what am I trying to accomplish by doing that? By bringing folks into my organization, what am I trying to accomplish? By bringing folks into my organization, what am I trying to solve? And those are two sides of the same coin. You know, you're trying to accomplish something which is forward-looking or strategic. You're trying to create something that doesn't exist. You're trying to establish something that hasn't been established before. This is new work of some sort. You know, this is the positive side. You're trying to accomplish something. What is that? By bringing people in your organization, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, and then the flip side of that, or the negative side of that, and these things go together, is what are you trying to solve? So there's some things that are happening that are broken, some things that aren't working very well, some things that need tuned up, or some things that are costing you time or money or energy or reputation. There's some problems you're trying to solve, right? And what are those? And so it's very good for you to kind of get right out of the gate before you start interviewing anybody, these things, to say to yourself, I'm trying to solve what? I'm trying to accomplish what? And it's not as simple as saying, well, I'm trying to accomplish hiring somebody. That's very generic and obvious. So I want you to dig deeper and say, by hiring people, what am I trying to solve? Because you're going to accidentally fall for the fog the mirror kind of trick, you know, where you've got somebody sitting in front of you that seems to have some proficiency in the role that you're looking to hire, and they just kind of talk you into it. And I would call that the ugly girlfriend syndrome, right? Where you fall for this person for these qualities that really don't make any sense, and you end up hiring somebody for one or two qualities that kind of wow you, and later you kind of wake up and say, what in the world was I thinking? Like, why did I hire this person? They're no good at all these other things, or they're really good at this one thing, but we don't like working with them. And that's what this sort of assessment or question or process called the ideal team player is meant to help you avoid. It's meant to help you avoid hiring someone simply because of their skill set, simply because of their proficiency at a particular endeavor. And that's important, okay, to have proficiency in whatever you're hiring for, obviously. But we end up hiring somebody, if we're not careful, And I see this all the time. I would say if this is normal, actually, to hire somebody who has quote unquote proficiency, but they're not humble, they're not hungry, or they're not smart, or they're not, or they're only some fraction of those, and they're not all three of those. You could have somebody that's great at what they do, but if they don't fit your culture, if they don't fit how you do things kind of personally, or maybe as a entity, not so much as a particular process, here's how we do stuff, but more like, hey, here's how we treat each other, here's how we think, here's how we act, you're going to have a bad hire, even though they're good at what they do, right? And so we need to kind of avoid that. Now, so the first step is keep this macro thing in mind, you know, very broad. How does hiring fit into our macro strategy? Why are we hiring? What are we trying to accomplish and solve by hiring? Think about past bad hires and think about what those costs were and say, okay, why did we think that hire in the past was good? When did we determine they were bad or not worth having in the organization? And remember, you're hiring more than just a quote hire. You're not just quote hiring people to do work. You're trying to add members to your team. You're trying to grow your team, not just grow your productivity or grow your output. You're literally adding members to a high performing team, which is going to impact your culture. And you're trying to expand your culture, or you're trying to protect your culture. And when you add this person, a person, it has a big impact on that. So that's really important to remember. Secondly, so the first is remember the big picture and get your hands around or your head around the big picture. Secondly, in the interviewing process, you want to mix it up a little bit. You want to change up how you do, where you do it, and who you do it with, and kind of change up the context. Now, you do want to build a process. You want to build a process around, hey, here's how we interview. But I don't want you to be prescriptive here. I want you to be more principled. Principled is in the sense like a process that's got principles in it, not so much a process that is a paint-by-number process, but more of a process that's full of principles or guides or concepts, not so much a laundry list or a punch list, okay? But more of a principled list. So mix it up, right? That's the second big bullet point here is mix up when you do interviewing, mix up a couple things. First of all, mix up who's in the room with you. One rule of thumb, this comes from Top Grading by Brad Smart, the book Top Grading, which I would encourage you to read if you're a hiring professional. If you have a bunch of people in your business, guess what? Your new day job is getting really good at hiring people. And it's not as a CEO or as a leader, it's not okay for you to sub that out to HR. You need to be involved in bringing people into this business, regardless of how many people you have. Now, if you're a major, massive, publicly traded corporation, it's, 3,000, 4,000 people, we're talking about something else, right? But if you have a 50 or a 100 or 11 or 92 employees or 30 employees, and you're the CEO or the leader or the visionary or the owner or the chief, the chief person, you better get really good at attracting folks and really good at determining if the person in front of you belongs in this organization, and really good at doing that along with your other key leaders and teaching them how to do it. So mix it up, right? So mix up location. First of all, it makes sense to have interviews in the place of business, in your office, in the break room, or at, wherever your business functions, it's a no-brainer to have some interviews there or have one of many interviews there. And as a side note, I would encourage you to have multiple interviews, definitely more than one. And I would suggest four or five passes at determining, are we talking to the right person here? So in those four or five interviews, mix up the locations. You know, there's different places around your professional space. There's restaurants. You can go to the park. You can go to other professional spaces. For instance, if you have a professional space where you go to do creative work offsite, you know, an offsite sort of meeting space, those are all good. You can go to a bowling alley. You can go to kind of social places. I mean, bowling alley, of course, is just one, but to mix it up, right? And you want to just kind of change the room, all right, and keep them. I'm not going to say off. I don't mean off balance, but to just keep them engaged in what we're doing here, and not to dumb down the process. All right, and when you mix up locations, you create some movement here that can be very good in you and them determining, do we belong together? Secondly, I think mix up the context. Okay, so the first context, obvious context, is a professional setting. We're sitting at a boardroom table or something like that, and you're kind of going through resume and all that. You know, which I think is about 10% effective. There's value there. It's a good starting point, but you're going to want to move past that really fast and mix up the context. So mix up, are we in a professional setting, a personal setting, a social setting? And you're going to be dealing with this person in all those settings, all right? And all those settings are really valuable for you to get to know them and for them to get to know you, because they're trying to make the same assessment, right? They're trying to assess, hey, is this the right place for me to hitch my wagon, so to speak, for the next professional season here, whether it's 5 years or 25 years. They are trying to determine the same thing you are. And they need, you're doing them a favor, actually. You're doing them a solid by helping them see you in different settings. So we got different locations, we got different contexts, and then we need to have different people in the room. You really need to mix up the different folks that are interacting with this person for a number of reasons. One is that when you bring different people into these interviews, you're bringing a different set of eyes for your benefit. You're getting a different vantage point that you don't have, right? The other folks are seeing things you're not seeing. They're hearing things you're not seeing. Side note here, never, ever interview alone. Again, this comes from Top Grading, kind of a tome, if you will, on interviewing, which I've read and gone through a number of years ago. But it's, again, if you're an interviewer, professional hirer of people, that is a great book. There's others out there as well. But one of the big takeaways from that is never interview alone. And so have other people in the room with you and mix up who those people are. Key leaders, senior leaders, you could say like kind of line level staff. You want them to be good. You want to trust their instincts. They need to be trained up a little bit on how we do this interviewing business. You want to give them a little bit of leeway. But you also want to coach them in, hey, this is why we're doing this. Now, the reason, and second, why you want these folks, other folks in the room, is they are carrying the fire of the culture. They're carriers of the flame, so to speak. And they have a big voice in this culture. And you want them engaged. You want them involved in deciding, or at least getting a view of who's coming in the front door. And they need to be included in that. Not everybody. And it's not a committee, decision, right? This is your decision. But you need to engage the other folks that are involved in your culture, and that helps them say, man, I get a voice in this. And it helps them to be even more engaged in the culture. Third reason to bring other people into the room is your future hire, this person you're interviewing, is saying to themselves, man, this is a very deep and broad organization. They're saying to themselves, you rely on lots of folks. And they're saying, man, I might become one of those folks. You're basically sowing some seeds here of the future for this person, and you're setting the stage for what they can expect down the road. Okay? Some very broad, basic tips. Now, an ideal team player is hungry, humble, and smart. All right? Now, if you don't agree with that, you might just need to roll on to another podcast. But think about that. So humble, I'm going to define this. I'm going to say here's how he defines it, how Lencioni defines it anyway. And that is, you know, kind of a no-brainer. Just not full of yourself, thinking about other people. He defines it as focusing on the greater good instead of focusing on yourself or having an inflated ego. This is the most important trait I'm reading here from this summary of the book. The most important trait of being a great team player. Some of the behavioral traits of someone who's humble. People who are humble tend to use we instead of I. They aren't afraid to own up to their flaws or failures. They're willing to apologize for the mistakes, to accept others' apologies, and they can sincerely appreciate others' strengths of skills and skills. Here's a sign that of someone who lacks humility. Those who lack humility may be explicitly arrogant or self-centered, with a tendency to boast or seek attention. And here's some nuances. Humility is not the same as insecurity or a lack of self-confidence or a lack of self-worth. You can choose to focus less on yourself without discounting your strengths and contributions. Hungry. So we're going to define hungry here. Hungry means that you always seek more. For example, you do more, learn more, take in more responsibility. You could say here you're constantly growing. All right, behavioral traits of hungry. Hungry people are self-motivated. They embrace hard work with a sort of joyful sacrifice. And they don't insist, and that's in quotes, joyful sacrifice. They don't insist on the predictable 9-to-5 schedule. They see challenges and hardships as a chance to learn, grow, and contribute. They take the initiative to think several steps ahead and seek out opportunities. Okay, so that's Lencioni's definition of hungry. Now, here's a sign that people lack hunger. People who lack hunger tend to do only what's expected of them. I would say here they just check the box. They may not have a long list of activities outside of work, or they constantly negotiate their... work hours. Now, this isn't to say that folks that are, you know, have a lot going on outside of work are bad hires. It's just a sign that they're not going to be really, really engaged in what they're doing inside of work. Some nuances here. Hunger is not the same as selfish ambition. Example, hunger shouldn't be directed toward personal interests at the expense of the team. Now, remember, again, we're talking about team players here. Okay, so he defines smart, the third behavioral trait, as he says, smart people are aware of and perceptive about other people. They tend to ask good questions, listen intently, and respond effectively to people. So he's kind of saying that they're self-aware, and they're aware of what others are doing. They're kind of paying attention. This isn't so much about intelligence as it is about awareness. I think you could insert here EQ as an emotional intelligence. Okay, so that's some of the behavioral traits of smart signs that you lack this smartness. Those who lack this virtue tend to be clueless about group dynamics and the impact of their words and actions on others. They offend people not because of bad intentions, but because they don't know or slash consider how others may respond. Some nuances here. Being smart is not about intellectual capacity. It's somewhat simpler and is somewhat simpler than emotional intelligence. Okay, so I'm going to take and read a little bit about his, what it looks like if you're one, two, or two of these together. So first of all, if you're simply humble, if you're not hungry, you're not smart, but you're simply humble, he calls that the pawn. So basically someone who's simply humble just kind of gets run over. Others walk all over them. They don't truly drive team performance or influence their teammates. That's kind of his definition of the pawn. If you're humble and hungry, he defines that as the bulldozer. So somebody who's humble and hungry, they end up focusing on results without considering the impact of others. Those who are, that's just hungry only. Sorry. So if you're just hungry only, he calls that the bulldozer. Now that's what I'll do. I'll just do the single ones here first. So pawn is, just humble. The bulldozer is just hungry. You're just plowing over people. And if you're just smart, we call that the charmer. All right. So the charmer, likable, but not really contributing to the team. That's the charmer. Let me pour some more coffee here. So now let me talk about what it means to be humble and hungry, but not smart. All right, humble and hungry, but not smart, is what he calls the accidental mess maker. Those who are humble and hungry but not smart are accidental mess makers. They do their best to contribute but are oblivious to their interpersonal problems they create. They can usually correct their behaviors with the right guidance. All right, people who are humble and smart are the lovable slacker. And this is all laid out in a Venn diagram. So you take these three qualities and do a Venn diagram overlapping circles. Oh, this is what he's talking about here. So if humble and hungry, but not smart, you're the accidental mess maker. Humble and smart, but not hungry, is a lovable slacker. They do what's requested of them at work, but they may direct more energy to other passions or commitments outside of work. The challenge will be to motivate them to step up and contribute more to the team. All right, now there's a blend here called hungry and smart, but not humble. And he says this is one of the most dangerous. He calls this the skillful politician. Somebody's hungry and smart, but they're not humble. They focus their ambitions and hard work on their own interests and benefits. Yet such people tend to rise in the organizational hierarchy of cultures where performance is rewarded over teamwork. Okay, so the ideal team player has all three. So if you're simply smart, you're the charmer. If you're simply hungry, you're the bulldozer. If you're simply humble, you're the pawn. If you're humble and smart but not hungry, we call that the lovable slacker. If you're smart and hungry but not humble, we call that the skillful politician. And if you're hungry and humble but not smart, we call that the accidental mess maker. Okay, now here's some great questions when you're interviewing. And I'm just going to go through these questions and then we're going to wrap it. Okay, I just want to give you something to chew on. All right. So these are nested, first of all, in questions around each of these three qualities. So first round, humble. Humble team members quick to point out the contribution of others and slow to seek attention on their own. They share credit, emphasize team over self, and define success collectively rather than individually. So sitting down to do an interview, it's important that you and the other person that you're interviewing, that's interviewing alongside of you, understand that we got to figure out this person's humble. Now, here's a great question. Describe your current team. What do you like and dislike? Now, insight, so things to look for when you ask this question. By asking a team-related question, it may be apparent if he or she values a team effort and is willing to do what is necessary for the good of the team. Encourage the candidate to describe the specific interactions with colleagues and experiences working on a team. Another question, what are the most important accomplishments of your career? Insight, look for more mentions of we than I. Of course, it isn't about being so simplistic as to count the responses. In the event that someone refers to himself or herself individually more than as a member of the team, probe for whether he or she was working alone or with others. Another question, what was the most embarrassing moment in your career or the biggest failure? Insight. Look for whether the candidate celebrates that embarrassment or is mortified by it. Humble people generally aren't afraid to tell their unflattering stories because they're comfortable with being imperfect. Also, look for the specifics and real references to the candidate's own culpability. And I think that's a really good point there. Humble people generally aren't afraid to tell their unflattering stories because they're comfortable with being imperfect. That's part of what it means to be humble. Arrogant people, I have found, and if you think about this, I think you'll see this is true in your situation as well. Arrogant people are mortified that people are going to find out about their flaws. They're trying hard to protect themselves. They're actually insecure, I would say, generally speaking. All right, here's another question. How did you handle the embarrassment or failure? Insight, look for specifics about how the candidate accepted responsibility, what they learned from it, and if they actually acted on what was learned. Another good question. What was your greatest weakness? What is your greatest weakness? Yes, this is a seemingly tired question, but it's still a useful one. The key is to look for answers that are real and a little painful. Candidates who present their weaknesses as strengths, as in, I take on too much, or I have a hard time saying no, are often afraid to acknowledge real shortcomings. To avoid this, it's a good idea to coach candidates with prompts like, I really want to know what you'd like to change about yourself, or better yet, what your best friend would say you need to work on. The key to the answer is not what their weaknesses are, unless, of course, the candidate is an axe murderer, but if they're comfortable acknowledging something real. Okay, here's another question. How do you handle apologies, either giving or accepting them? Last question is, can you tell me about someone who is better than you in an area that really matters to you? And look for the candidate to demonstrate a genuine appreciation for others who have more skill or talent. Okay, so those are some good questions around humble. I'm going to go through some good questions around hungry. So again, a hungry team members are self-motivated, diligent. They're constantly thinking about the next step and the next opportunity, looking forward. Question, what is the hardest you've ever worked on something in your life? Insight, look for specific examples of real but joyful sacrifice. In other words, the candidate isn't complaining, but is grateful for the experience. Another question, what do you like to do when you're not working? Insight, look out for too many time-consuming hobbies that suggest the candidate sees the job as a means to do other things. That's not to say that there is one specific kind of activity that is an indicator of not being hungry. It's certainly not to say that you're looking for someone who has no interests outside of life in life outside of work. But a long list of hobbies like extreme skiing, dog sled racing, storm chasing, shark hunting might be a red flag when it comes to someone who is not going to put their needs of the team ahead of personal pursuits. Good question here is, what was your work ethic like as a teenager? Insight, look for specifics usually relating to schoolwork, sports, and jobs. When it comes to sports, it's not about participation and having fun. Look for examples of difficulty, sacrifice, and hardship. Ask the candidate about how hard they worked in high school. Did they really strive to do well? Did they have a job? Did they train extraordinarily hard in a sport? You're not looking for one particular answer, but rather for something real that indicates the person has a work ethic. And a work ethic usually, but not always, gets established early in life. Now, a good book around this, side note, I covered this a number of episodes ago, is the book called Grit by Angela Duckworth. And it gets into that exact truth, that the number one indicator of someone's kind of grittiness or ability to stick to things is, did they have some serious extracurricular hobbies, but like sports or music or drama, those kind of things that were hard, that took commitment, that took a lot of practice in their high school, or kind of the developmental time between 14, 18 or so. And those were really good indicators of grit. Okay, another question. What kinds of hours do you generally work? Insight. Hardworking people usually don't want to work 9 to 5 unless their unique life situations demand it. If they do, they're usually getting additional work done at home. Sorry, I'm choking on my coffee. That's not to say that some people aren't stuck in dead-end 9-to-5 jobs and are itching to get out to do something challenging. But if a candidate is satisfied with a predictable schedule and talks too much about, quote, balance, there's a chance he or she isn't terribly hungry. Again, not a litmus test, but a red flag. None of this is to advocate that people should prioritize their work over their families, not at all. It's just when a candidate focuses a lot on the hours that they're expected to work, they may not be the kind of hungry team player you need. Okay, so there's some questions around hungry. Here's some questions around smart. He defines smart as team members that are interpersonally appropriate and aware. They have good judgment and intuition around the subtleties of group dynamics and the impact of their words and actions. Question: have you ever worked with a difficult colleague or boss? How did you handle the situation? Insight. By asking the candidate about a difficult work relationship, you'll learn if he or she can read situations and people and handle them skillfully. Question: how would you describe your personality? Insight: look for how accurately the person describes what you are observing and how introspective he or she is. Smart people generally know themselves and find it interesting to talk about their behavioral strengths and weaknesses. People who seem stumped or surprised by this question might not be terribly smart when it comes to people. Question: what do you do that others in your personal life might find annoying? Insight: everyone annoys someone sometimes, especially at home. Smart people are not immune to this, but neither are they in the dark about it. They tend to moderate these behaviors at work. Question: what kind of people annoy you the most, and how do you deal with them? Insight: what you're looking for here is the candidate's self-awareness and self-control. Smart people know their pet peeves, and they own the fact that some of those pet peeves are their own issues. They also know how to deal with annoying people in a productive, constructive way. Question: would your former colleague describe you as an empathic person, or can you give an example of how you've demonstrated empathy to a teammate? Insight: some people use the word empathic. The issue is whether the candidate seems to understand what others are feeling. Now there are certain personality types that are less empathic than others, and that's fine. What we're looking for here is an indication that the person values empathy and whether he or she has an understanding of his or her own strengths and weaknesses in this area. Now, I've read those questions for you, not so that you can have a recipe, not so that you can have a prescription. I've read these questions to you so that you can develop some principles to take these questions, jot them down, and think about why they're valuable questions and come up with a list of your own. If you're going to be a professional leader and a manager, you must develop your ability to interview people. And these are good questions around interviewing for qualities that are solid, healthy, wholesome, non-negotiable qualities in members of your team that are crushing it. You know, they're good folks, they're sweet folks, they're hardworking folks, they're good team members. So I just want to kind of drop that into your thinker. If you get on Pat Lencioni's website, tablegroup.com, or the table group, I guess it is, .com. No, it's just tablegroup.com. He has also a manager's assessment, some ways that you can look at hungry, humble, and smart. This, I would not go through this with your direct report, but do it before you sit down with them. And that's a nice little side hack there, by the way. If you're not sitting down with your direct report substantively, at least once a year. And if you're sitting down once a year and doing a one-year review, like, look, that's got some value, but you should be doing much more than that. In that sit down, you need to come to that prepared. You need to take some time ahead of that sit down and do some thinking. And I would suggest take a couple hours or more to make some notes, to make some observations, to make yourself a little plan, a theme, some bullet points. Here's what I want to communicate. Here's what I'll make sure happens here, to make a set of objectives that you want to come away from that meeting with two or three or four accomplishments or truths or takeaways. You know, you need to go into that thing as a pro, and pros practice what they're good at. Okay. Amateurs don't practice. And I would say pros get coaches too. Amateurs never get coaches. Pros always get coaches. Whether it's a pro sport or pro acting or pro business leader. Okay. So side note, shameless plug. I'm available. So there you go. Just wanted to poke at it a little bit, this interviewing process, and fan the flames a little bit. Would love for you to get a hold of me. If you have any questions, email me at mwhitmore@lodestonetruenorth.com. Hope you enjoyed this episode 060, Lodestone True North Business Broken to Smoking podcast in the can. See you later.